Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I'm Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions. That's right, Joel. This is our Ask How to Money episode where we are going to answer five questions, including one about medical tourism. I'm really excited to take that one. We've got a question about open enrollment, which is also on a lot of people's minds these days, and another about investing locally and our thoughts on that, maybe how to go about that, some ways to think about it, plus a couple other questions.
There we go. Let's get to it in just a second. But before we hit up those questions, Matt, I wanted to mention that I went on a hike recently when I took my family up to Chattanooga, which is a lovely place, lovely little town about an hour and a half outside of Atlanta. And one of my friends recommended this cool waterfall hike. And I was like, okay, sweet. Yeah, this would be great. He said it was good. We've got a toddler. Even he can handle it. And he was able to. It was a really fun hike. And waterfalls are the best. Like, what's better than a good waterfall selfie?
Very well. Not the selfie as much as for me. I like actually, so in the summertime when you can go swimming, actually swimming at the base of a waterfall, like in the pool, like that's, I feel like what you can't beat.
Yeah, yeah, that's fun. And there was this
that
like
calls
little,
me back to the wild when I do that.
There was this little pool up top and we did like wade in and play around. That was a lot of fun.
No, not at the top, at the bottom.
Well, like, it was kind of one of those like, you know, some waterfalls, they're not like perfect in their nature. So it wasn't like that. But
you
know,
you play around in the pool at the top of the waterfall, you always got to be careful.
Well, yes.
You don't
want to get swept over. There was a place where you could do it safely. But yeah, so I found it interesting though, right before we went, there was a 1-star review of this trail. And overall, the reviews were like, I don't know, so 4.7, 4.8 stars. Most people were like, this is great, or this is really good.
Yeah.
And one person was like, this trail stinks because there was a tree down and I had to hop over it and it was a big pain. And it just, what struck me in
bathrooms weren't outfitted very well, no snack bar.
Right.
It's like, Wait a minute, is this a person that just doesn't like the outdoors?
That was kind of my thoughts. And
maybe
I was like,
so.
I was also kind of thinking that your perspective, your outlook is kind of key. It has a lot to do with everything. And so if you're going to an outdoor nature trail, you're hiking a mile and a half to get to this cool waterfall that, you know, where you can wade in the pool and play around, and you're deterred by a tree that fell down in the middle of the path, then maybe this isn't your style. Like, maybe this isn't your jam. But it just made me think there's so many things in life that really our outlook is key. It could really make or break the experience that we have in so many facets of our lives. And so, yeah, I kind of chuckled when I read that, but I was also like, man, there's like a metaphor here for the person who's willing to leave a 1-star review for this like dope waterfall trail.
Yeah, honestly, dude, this, you know, reminds me of the fact that I kind of have a love-hate relationship when it comes to different review sites and the ability for folks to provide feedback, some input when it comes to certain things like trails and even beers, right? Like, I really appreciate the fact that I can look up a beer on Untappd and see just overall what kind of rating it gets. Certainly, there are going to be some haters out there, but like, what are your thoughts just in general with like the ability to rate things?
Well, I think when we leave our opinions online, we're more likely to be unfiltered and rude. I think, you know, that's what the comment section is on the internet. Or we're maybe more willing to like bash something than we otherwise would be. I think if someone asked this reviewer after the hike, hey, how was the hike? She or he might have been like, yeah, it was fun. We saw a cool waterfall. But then they leave the review and they're like, 1 star. It was the worst day ever. And so, I don't know. The online review space is an interesting one. I think you have to take those reviews with a grain of salt. And you have to read enough to get
an accurate picture.
Exactly.
Yeah, overall.
Because if you read two or three, you might get the people that were either just like, they're happy about everything and that's cool. But
yeah,
if you read the negative Nellies, it can completely taint your view of something that might end up being good for you or working out for you.
Yeah. And I feel like, I mean, for you and I, we do read the reviews for our podcast and it helps us to be able to make small little tweaks here and there. But we're not going to just let a single bad review take us down, right? It's somebody that's like, oh, don't like beer. Podcast not for me. It's just like, well, that's certainly a part of our podcast, but we like to talk about a lot of other financially related things as well.
And you know what? A recent review said, I don't really like craft beer, but I still love this podcast. And those are the kind of reviews I like.
Exactly. So, well, on that note, let's share that on this episode, you and I are going to enjoy a schmoogie box. And you heard me say that correctly. We'll talk more about this beer by Imprint Beer Company at the end of this episode.
No doubt. Let's get on to the listener questions, though. And if you have a question you want to ask Matt and I, and you want us to answer it on an upcoming Ask HTM episode, just go to howtomoney.com/ask. There are simple instructions there for you to submit your voice memo, and hopefully we can take your question on the next Ask HTM episode. All right, Matt, this first question, though, is about medical tourism.
Hi, Joel and Matt. My name is Nicole, and I'm from North Carolina. I'm an avid listener, and I'm hoping you can help me out with this question. I'll be traveling next month to Costa Rica for some medical procedures. I'm able to pay at the time of service, and the surgeon is requesting cash or cashier's check. I can use my credit card, but that would also add 5% onto the cost of surgery. Should I carry cash or cashier's check, or be safe and use my credit card? Thank you so much, and I appreciate all of your thoughts.
All right, Nicole, thanks for your question. And first of all, medical tourism, totally underrated, speaking of the ability to rate things, underrated, underutilized. We feel that going elsewhere makes sense for a lot of folks.
That's where I'm going for my bicep implants, Matt.
I thought you're more into the calf implants, right?
Maybe next time.
We feel this makes sense because of just where health prices have gone here in the U.S. They have taken off. And the Medical Tourism Association, they say that you can save up to 90% by taking advantage of medical tourism. So that is a lot of money when procedures can cost in the tens of thousands of dollars, even more than that. But most folks will see savings in the 50 to 70% range. Recently, we had Marshall Allen on, and we actually didn't discuss medical tourism all that much, but he actually mentioned the best healthcare experience of his life and how that was actually in Kenya, not here in the U.S. And so, yeah, getting certain procedures done in other countries can make a lot of sense. It can save you a lot of money and allow you to get a little bit of vacation time in at the same time. And so the CDC, they actually have a solid overview that we'll link to in our show notes, but that can provide you with some more information. But all that to say, it is important to, you know, to mention that medical tourism does come with risks, and you want to make sure that you keep those in mind. And again, refer to that briefing by the CDC.
Yeah, and you want to make sure you're keeping your doctor here in the States informed about what you're up to. That's an important piece of the puzzle too. And, Nicole, we'll get to your question in just one second, but I want to mention that Costa Rica, where Nicole is going, Matt, is quickly becoming one of those top countries, one of the biggest destinations in the world when it comes to medical tourism. You know, Mexico is becoming a popular destination for people to get dental work.
Might have to go down there soon myself if I keep delaying going to the dentist.
I forget the actual name of the town, but there's a town in Mexico that everyone refers to as Molar City because
that's
where people go to get their crowns put in or whatever. They head down there. It's like right across the border, and they get their dental work done. Come on back. Hungary apparently is another one of those countries where there's just a lot of medical tourism and dental tourism too. But that's a little bit further away. I can't imagine many How to Money listeners going to Hungary for their healthcare.
You never know.
But yeah, interestingly enough, the customer care is often superior in these locations too. You might even have your own private nurse, whereas some of the U.S. hospitals might be a little more short-staffed. You might get better attention actually by going overseas for your care. And yeah, basically, if you're looking to travel to have medical work done, here's the thing. You don't want to go just anywhere. I think that's what freaks people out. That's why so many people don't go, is because you just assume, and in many cases, rightly so, that the United States has the best healthcare in the world. But there are ways to vet a medical facility in a foreign country before you book that surgery or dental work. And the thing you want to make sure is that it's accredited, that facility, with the Joint Commission International. And that is, it goes a long way towards being able to know that the doctor and the facility have a reputation that you can trust, because this commission vets providers based on world health standards. So what they're saying is, hey, does this facility in Costa Rica, does this dental center in Mexico, do they meet standards that we would say are sufficient for quality care? And if they have that stamp of approval, I would feel totally comfortable going and having my medical care taken care of there.
That's right. But let's go ahead and get to the core of Nicole's question, which is, how should she be paying for this procedure? Well, first of all, we'll say that we're not huge fans of her first option, which is paying cash. However, if there's an ATM on site where she can withdraw cash, that's going to make that option a little more appealing. But for instance, if she has to withdraw, you know, money at an airport ATM and then travel with it, well, that's a little less appealing as a single individual traveling alone in a foreign country. But either way, check your debit card foreign transaction fees first before you make any cash withdrawals. A cashier's check that you mentioned there, Nicole, that's going to solve some of these problems. But it's also worth asking if you could use a service like Wise.com. It used to be called TransferWise, now they're called Wise, to transfer funds to them instead. Both cashier's checks and digital transfers are both really cheap ways to make that payment internationally, but neither of them offers the protection that you would get with a credit card, which is why both of those options, all those options are going to be a little inferior, in our opinion, than using a credit card.
That's true, Matt. And you mentioned getting cash out of an ATM, which is the way you're going to pay the least in like currency fees. Because like, let's say Nicole were to go somewhere in the United States and get that the colones, which is the Costa Rican currency, get that ahead of time. Well, let's say you went to your bank or something nearby. You're going to pay a higher exchange rate to do it there than you are going to pay just snagging money out of the ATM at the airport. But yeah, let's talk about credit cards. Since your surgeon does accept credit cards, this is probably the best option for you. And you mentioned paying 5% more. Well, to pay 5% more for peace of mind isn't that bad. But here's the thing. You actually won't be paying 5% more if you pay with a card that has top-notch rewards and zero foreign transaction fees. And in fact, if you sign up for a new credit card before you go on your trip, this procedure alone that you're having done could help you hit a spending limit in order to snag a sign-up bonus, maybe like the Chase Sapphire card with $1,250 cash back right now, which is still the richest sign-up bonus we've seen from Chase. And let's say...
Or from any card issuer.
Right, yeah. It's the best one we've really ever seen. And let's say, for instance, Nicole, that your procedure cost $4,000. You would end up paying a $200 fee. Yes. But and everyone knows, Matt and I, we don't like fees. So why would we tell you to do this? Well, you would still come out over $1,000 on top because of that sign-up bonus you would get from getting that new Chase card. And yeah, you'll probably feel a lot more comfortable not carrying bukus of foreign currency on your person as you're navigating the airport and transportation to and from the medical facility. I can understand how it would make you feel uncomfortable. And so, yeah, we would say in this case, the fee probably makes sense and you can actually somehow make it work to your advantage. You can come out on top and pay the fee at the same time.
Yeah, one other thing that's worth noting too is Nicole mentioned that she has the ability to pay for that procedure at the time of the procedure, which is really important because what we're not advocating for here is to use a credit card when you don't have the ability to pay for that in the here and now.
True.
And obviously the benefit is that you don't have to pay right away with a credit card. You can wait until the end of the month to close out that statement. But we don't want you to finance, you know, any expenses. And that's regardless as to whether or not those expenses take place here in the U.S. or in Costa Rica.
True. But,
yeah, Joe, so medical tourism, would you do it?
Of course I would.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. And actually, like I think, yeah, like we said, there's a lot to love about it. And especially, yeah, if you look at the savings, if you get a couple quotes from doctors in your area and you're like, this just is not going to work out. And you can save 70 or 80%.
Sure. Yeah.
And especially, like we said, if you can get, you know, a few days before the procedure to be able to enjoy yourself, you know, even including the cost of your airfare and hotel stay potentially, if you're still able to save 40-50%, make it happen. I love that. I would totally do it too. I would, again, like we said, I would be cautious. I would be careful. I would attempt to do it the right way, making sure I'm getting high quality medical care, but I would totally do it.
Yeah. I still can't shake the scene in Minority Report where Tom Cruise's character, he's getting like a double eye transplant, like in this sketchy, nasty, like apartment building, basically, so that he's not like found out by the robots.
Cause right.
they do the eye scans or whatever. He like wakes up. He's like in a bathtub of like ice. It's just a bad, bad scene. It gets really dark. And it had a really big impact on me as a kid, thinking I never want to wake up somewhere where I'm not sure, you know, where I am or what has just happened to my body.
Well, this is definitely one of those things where, you know, we give the frugal or cheap conundrum. But I think if you do it properly, it can be
totally frugal.
It can be a frugal move for sure. And yeah, best of luck to you, Nicole, with these procedures that you're going to make happen. All right. We got a couple more questions to get to, including one actually about credit cards and credit card limits. We'll get to that one first right after this break.
We'll be right back.
right, we're back from the break, and we've got a question from a listener who is realizing that her mom may have been misinformed when it came to credit card limits. Let's hear it.
Hey, Joel and Matt. My name is Julia, and I was just listening to episode 412 of the listener questions, where one listener was asking about closing his credit card, and you both explained how having a lot of debt available to you actually is good for your credit score. And this brought up a question in my mind, because I remember as a kid, my mom would always be ticked whenever she saw that her credit card limit would go up. And so I wanted to ask you, was she right in being ticked for some reason, or was this just a false impression she had? Thanks.
All right, Matt, we don't want to make Julia feel poorly about her mom. I'm sure her mom did a great job raising her.
That's not anything we ever want anyone to feel poorly. Listen, towards the parents.
Don't trust your parents, okay? That's all I want to say here. No, Julia, your mom, I'm sure, wonderful lady, but there's a lot of people, Matt, that are misinformed about how credit scores work and what constitutes a good credit score. You know, when the credit card company offers you a credit limit increase, I could see why a lot of people would be like, I don't know, it sounds like you're trying to pull the wool over my eyes. And that's understandable, because it is kind of weird and convoluted how credit scores work sometimes. And yeah, Matt and I, neither of us, I don't think, would vouch for the system and say that if you could start one from scratch, this is exactly the way we draw it up. No, but it is the one we've got for the time being.
My system would have a lot more to do with money in the bank.
Because, yeah.
I mean, that has like basically no standing on our credit scores, which is ridiculous.
Well, we had a friend recently who was trying to apply for a mortgage, and he literally has multi-million-dollar net worth, but he's also retired early. And the bank says, "Well, what's your income?" And he says, "I don't have one. I don't have a job, but I have millions of dollars in my investment accounts over here." And they're like, "Yeah, we don't really look at that when it comes to approving you for the mortgage." So it gets a little silly. And yeah, for most folks, it really is. It's kind of like turning on a sporting event from another country. Like, let's say, Matt, have you ever watched a cricket match before in your life?
No. Although nearby, there is a park where there's a lot of international students, and they like to gather in that park. And I see them down there playing cricket. I have no idea how it works, though.
Me neither. Like, I've always kind of wondered, because I kind of grew up watching baseball, and I'm like, how similar are they? But there's a lot of weird rules, and so I totally would not understand what's going on, or at least they're weird for my estimation. But the same really is true for our credit system here in the U.S. And sadly, a lot of Americans are just not giving their credit scores the time of day, and those who are paying attention may not even understand how they work, since the rules are so incredibly muddy.
Luckily, they're not as muddy as Whackbat, which is you remember that game from Fantastic Mr. Fox? Similar to cricket, but just like even more complicated and nonsensical.
Still one of my favorite movies.
It's very good. And so, you know, Julie, it does sound like your mom was confused about the rules when it comes to her credit score. Again, that's understandable, because it makes sense that having more debt offered to you would be a bad thing, right? But in this convoluted world of credit scores, it's almost like this badge of honor. What the credit bureaus and potential lenders want to see is that you have access to different types of credit while using very little of what's actually available to you. It might be akin to someone advising you on your diet, and then they kind of test you by putting a box of donuts in front of you to see if you have the willpower, the self-control to not eat any. It's kind of messed up. But that's actually kind of how it works when it comes to credit. It's like, hey, look at all of these things that are available to you. If you touch them, you're going to get punished.
Yeah, it is. It's exactly like that. And hopefully, yeah, your dietitian would not put a box of donuts in front of you and just, you know, see if you can resist. But that's how it works in credit scores. That reminds me of another movie of Dodgeball, when I think Ben Stiller's character is like giving himself an electric zap every time he eats a donut. But yeah, let's move on. So let's talk about the main things that actually do make up your credit score. Credit utilization is the second biggest factor. That's really what we're talking about here. It's basically ideal to have a giant balance that you use very little of. And the specific amount that you want to shoot for is to be using on a monthly basis 10% of the credit that you have available or less. And so let's say you do have a $25,000 limit on your credit card. Using $2,500 at most in a month is going to be ideal when it comes to your credit score. And yeah, the top factor though is whether you pay your bills on time and in full. And I guess that one actually does make sense, even though the credit utilization is a bit convoluted. Just those two factors alone though, they make up like 2/3 of your score. And so if you're doing those two things well, if you are paying your bills on time and in full, and you're using very little of that available credit, then your credit score is mostly going to be fine. The other three things that impact you are your length of credit history, opening new credit, and the mix of credit that you have. So having like a credit card and a mortgage and a student loan, basically the more different types of credit that
like,
you
have. Oh, this
have.
Guy has the trifecta. His score really goes up when in reality it's like, well, I mean, is that a good reason to see your score go up?
Right. Yeah, and the number of credit cards you have, like that's going to be a good thing too. If you have 5 credit cards that you handle well versus just one, that's going to work out better in your favor as well. But yeah, there's a lot of those factors, a lot of those things impacting ultimately that 3-digit score you're going to see at the end of the day. But really, when it comes down to it, that increased credit limit is a really good thing.
That's right. Julie, it's going to be good for your credit score. And it's not the way that we would have designed it, but those are the rules. And so your mom and all of us actually should be excited next time the credit card company bumps up our credit limit. This actually happened to me recently. I got a new credit card for some specific spending that I won't get into just now. But I was kind of bummed.
Now we're all curious.
It's a card specifically for going out to eat. 4 times the rewards on going out to eat.
Okay.
So we'll talk about it soon because I'm going to have to update the different cards that I carry in my wallet because I've gotten hyper specific with them.
Okay.
But I was bummed because initially my credit limit was only $1,200 and I thought that's not very high. That's a very low limit.
Did you say, don't you know who I am?
And it's not because I was going to spend $1,200 every single month on that card, but it's just because I wanted to steer clear of approaching, you know, anything near 10% of my overall credit limit. But a month later, you know, they saw that I was a big boy. They bumped that up literally from $1,200 to $12,000. And I was like, okay, that puts me in a much more comfortable position. And so by default, this will make us look better from a credit perspective. But we all need to make sure that we're being disciplined enough to not let that increased limit affect how much we are going to actually spend. Just because the credit card company says that you now have access to, you know, $20,000 instead of $200, that doesn't mean that you should use it. And Julie, in your case, maybe your mom was incredibly wise and she was focusing on the discipline side of things, right? She knew that, oh, with that increased limit, that might be tempting her to spend money when she shouldn't have. So maybe in the end, your mom had it right. Maybe she actually knew that was going to be a bad thing for her personally. Oftentimes it does come down to knowing ourselves and how it is that we are going to respond to different changes in our finances like that.
All right, now you made me feel bad for calling out Julia's mom. And
positive spin, that's all.
Yeah, no, that's good. And now I feel bad and I'm sorry. I apologize to Julia's mom.
Sorry, Julia's mom.
All right, well, Julia, hopefully that answers your question. And Matt, I think that is a good point because sometimes that behavioral side, we talk about it a lot, that behavioral side of money has a huge impact on us. And if someone says, hey, out of the blue, guess what? You have an extra $10,000 you can spend if you want to. A lot of people, that's how people get into trouble. A lot of people
exactly.
do take advantage of it. And so it is right and important to mention that. But let's get to our next question, Matt. And this one is about investing where you live.
Hi, Joel. Hi, Matt. Brandon from Portland, Oregon here. Love the show, especially how you and your guests are so mindful about building financial literacy. My question for you is how can those of us without deep pockets invest in businesses that are not publicly traded? Knowing this may be hard to do within a retirement account, how can I put taxable investment dollars to work investing in the expansion of the neighborhood brewery or growth of our favorite local condiment maker? If you had $5,000 to invest locally, where would you start? Thanks.
All right, Brandon, thanks for that question, and we appreciate you listening. And thanks, too, for that note about financial literacy. We definitely want to make sure that folks with normal lives, normal incomes, are not only increasing their levels of financial literacy, but we're also on a mission to make sure that everyone out there is aware that they can achieve the ultimate goal of financial freedom. We want to consistently make it clear that you don't need super deep pockets in order to build wealth.
Yeah, and I think that's what turns a lot of people off from investing advice, from money advice in general, is they're like, I don't have enough money to listen to that. But that's not true. You can be fresh out of college, making it, you know, your first job. You can be in high school still, trying to learn the ropes. There is, hopefully, someone of every age and money background can learn and apply the concepts we talk about here at How to Money. That's the goal, at least. But let's get on to Brandon's question about investing locally. Matt, this is a toughie. And first, it often involves taking on a lot more risk to invest in just one company near where you live. It can involve locking up your money for a lot longer than you might be comfortable with if you're going to invest in a local business. And let's take the example that Brandon mentioned of investing in a local brewery.
Which is a great example, by the way, right?
It is. It's one of the perfect examples.
He's asking the right guys.
Not just because we love beer, but I have a friend actually who started a brewery and he took on investors. His brewery is open now. And his beers are excellent. And
some of the best in Atlanta.
Exactly. And yeah, my guess is that those investors will see a return at some point, which is great. But they're going to have to be patient. And if I remember correctly, the minimum that you could come to the table with was $25,000, right? That's a lot of money and that's a lot of eggs in one basket. Most people they'd have to write it off immediately. I don't have that kind of money, but other people who do would still be reticent, understandably, to put that much in one local business. I personally didn't feel financially ready for it at the time, even though I had this huge desire to see him launch and become successful. And now that he is doing, crushing it, it brings me a lot of joy. But still, I think I made the right decision because that's a big risk that I would have been taking on.
Yeah, our friend, the physician on fire, he wrote a great article about investing $10,000 in a local brewery specifically as well. He went into it knowing that this was probably going to be a bad investment, but he did it anyway. And actually, the literal title of that article is, I made a bad $10,000 investment.
So he really telegraphed it there.
Yeah.
He knew what he was doing.
We'll link to that one in the show notes. But he wanted to help fund a hometown brewery, and he had hopes of being able to drink delicious beer right around the corner from his house. And that hope for him was realized, but he didn't have high hopes of a solid return on his investment. Any investment in a local business, especially a local brick and mortar business where there's a lot of overhead, especially if you're talking about a local business like a restaurant, these are all going to be higher risk ventures. And it is important to approach those quote unquote investments with that in mind. You need to go at it with that mindset.
Okay. So here's what we would say, because we don't want to completely destroy Brandon's dreams of investing in awesome local companies.
That was us just hedging the advice now that we're about to give.
Exactly. Listen, it's probably not going to work out, and there's a good chance you could lose all your money.
And it's too much. Don't do it. That's not what we're saying.
Right. But if you're going to invest locally, only do so if you're already doing a great job investing in the other areas of your life. Specifically, if you've been doing well funneling money into tax-advantaged retirement accounts for a number of years, for quite a long time. If you've been building up a solid nest egg for your retirement inside of the number one place you should be doing that, then it can be more on your radar. And here's the thing, if you can't go into it with the mindset that our friend Physician on Fire had, knowing that it's likely a bad investment and that there's a good chance that you won't see a return on that money, much less even being able to see a return of those initial dollars that you put in, then we would say it's too risky of a venture for you. It's kind of like putting money in cryptocurrency. It's not a bad idea to own just a little bit, but only if you're crushing it in the important areas first and you realize the severe risks that come alongside doing so.
Yeah, you need to have your investment priorities in place. And Brandon, here's another piece of advice too. Then, I feel like this is going to sound a little bit lame. I know it's probably not what you want to hear, but instead of investing in that business hoping for growth, invest your dollars in the products that the company makes. For instance, you mentioned local condiments. I have no idea what you're talking about there, but it sounds kind of awesome. You can keep the Heinz shaming ketchup. Keep that stuff stocked up in your fridge.
And maybe send some my way too, because that sounds delicious.
If it's and I bet this already exists, honestly, but I always like combining a little bit of ketchup with a little bit of sriracha.
Oh, there you go.
Sriracha on its own, it brings good heat, but I feel like there's not enough flavor in that. Ketchup brings enough acidity, enough sweetness, enough saltiness. That's what I like personally. But this also makes me think of another kind of brewery-specific example, Brandon. One of our other local favorite breweries, Monday Night Brewing, they had this special club that they called the Garage Club back in the day, where you paid a premium to be a special member with access to different limited release beers. You get special merchandise, other goodies like that. it wasn't necessarily a deal per se, but those members and that additional funding allowed them to offset the cost of experimenting on some of their newer interesting beers, which was essentially the beginning of their barrel aging program, which looking back now, I'm just like, oh man, that was pretty cool to have gotten in on the ground floor of. Granted, it wasn't nearly $5,000. It cost me a whole lot less money to get involved with that. But the ability to participate, you know, kind of even on a more consumer level was really gratifying. And so we would encourage you to maybe even reach out to some of these local companies directly and see if they have any kind of program, like just something that you could participate in. And, you know, if maybe they don't, but if you and others, if there are enough folks reaching out to them, that might be something that they prioritize and create, and that would allow you to participate on a more local level. But again, just like what Joel said, you need to make sure you've got all of your other investing basics taken care of first. You need to have your priorities in place. And no matter what, just like we, you know, like you said, Joel, with crypto, we wouldn't recommend you putting any more than 5% of your overall portfolio into a single company like this, because in our opinion, that is too much risk.
So the immediate rule of thumb would be to say, if you're looking to invest $5,000, don't do it unless you have $100,000 in net worth invested inside of retirement accounts.
Boom.
Yep.
There you
and
go.
If that's not the case, then keep waiting, Brandon. But eventually, hopefully, you're able to not just enjoy the products that some of these local businesses make, but you're able to, in some way, fund their business, which would be awesome. I love that as a goal. It's just one of those things that can be really tricky, and it actually isn't very lucrative in many cases too. It really has to be just done out of love and care for your community, which I think is still a good reason to do it.
Sure.
If you're financially ready to do so. But Matt, let's get to a couple more questions, including one about FSAs and then another one about HSAs. We'll hit both right after this break.
All right, we are back from the break. FSAs, HSAs. What do all the acronyms mean? Well, let's start with FSAs first.
Hi guys, Ronica from Denver here. With open enrollment coming soon, I'm wanting your thoughts about what to consider when enrolling in the Dependent Care FSA. My husband and I both have plans. I anticipate our household income for 2022 to be between $110,000 and $150,000, and our daycare expenses should be around $18,000 for one dependent. How do we make this decision without knowing what the law and limits will be for 2022?
Ronica, that is a great question. And actually, open enrollment starts today on healthcare.gov for people around the country who are looking to sign up for a healthcare plan. So that's worth noting. And most private employers actually start doing open enrollment really, really soon. And so there are just a lot of things to consider when you're in the open enrollment period. Matt and I would always suggest to run the numbers and don't make snap decisions. Matt, I always found it interesting talking to coworkers, and they wanted to choose the one that had the lowest deductible. But it turns out that at the end of the year, most people were better served by sticking with the more high deductible plan. They were ultimately going to incur fewer out-of-pocket costs. And so, yeah, you have to know your own health history and kind of what you think you're going to spend on healthcare in the coming year. But it's really important not to just assume things and to actually think about it for a minute.
Yeah, and the same is true when it comes to the dependent care FSA. Child care, it's not cheap. And Ronica, this is an expense that her and her husband are both going to be facing more of this coming year. But if you're spending that much money, the good news is that a chunk of that expense won't be taxed if you take full advantage of the FSA that you have access to. That's what you're talking about doing here, Ronica. And you know, while the limits were temporarily doubled last year due to the pandemic, the New York Times is reporting that they'll be reverting back to the earlier limits, the regular limits, which are $5,000. And since you are looking at childcare costs in the $18,000 range, this certainly seems like a benefit that you will want to pounce on and take full advantage of, and make sure that your household is able to maximize that at the $5,000 limit.
And I know most of our listeners are astute and they know this, Matt, but it is important just to note that FSAs are different than HSAs. And we're actually going to take a question about HSAs after this. So we'll kind of get a chance to see the dichotomy.
Sure.
In this one segment.
Well, quickly, I just realized we have not defined these acronyms. We never want to be the people who are out there throwing out all the abbreviations and acronyms without making sure we just cover our bases and define them. But FSA stands for Flexible Spending Account. HSAs are for Health Savings Accounts. Proceed, Joel.
Okay. Yes. I appreciate you doing that. That's very important stuff. And you and I, we actually like both of these vehicles, but they have their pros and cons. So if you're in a high deductible health plan, then an HSA, it's great to have. And it's really about investing money for your future. Your goal is actually to not be taking money out of that account, even though you have the ability to do so for qualified health expenses. We'll get to more on that in the next question. But when it comes to your FSA, there are two different varieties. One, similar to an HSA, is for healthcare costs. But then the other, like Ronica's asking about, is for dependent care costs. It's for, you know, childcare, the costs that you're going to incur. And the great thing is putting money into an FSA, it shields you from tax on that money if it is used in the proper way. And here's the thing though, when it comes to the flexible spending accounts, you don't want to overfund these accounts and stick money in that you might not end up using. Because if you don't spend that money, it just goes up in smoke. It vanishes at the end of the year. You can usually roll over a certain amount of money. This year, you can roll over up to $1,000. Most years, it's closer to $500. And so let's say you think you're only going to need $2,000 worth of childcare expenses this coming year. Don't put in $5,000 just in case, because that's the max limit. Not in an FSA. that is a recipe for losing a good chunk of that money. But in Ronica's case, maxing that FSA out, because she knows she's going to exceed that $5,000 anyway, is the right thing to do.
Yes, you definitely want to keep that in mind. You can roll over some to spend in the following year, but only a limited amount. And so this is actually a good reminder to anyone who still has money left in their FSA for this year. Check and see how much of that money that your employer is going to allow you to roll into your FSA for next year. Make sure to do that. But then for all the rest of your money, make sure to spend it on eligible items that you can get reimbursed for. You can get some new glasses like I did fairly recently. You can stock up on Band-Aids for your kids. Even Ancestry DNA kits qualify, which is pretty cool. You might want to go digging into your past a little bit and see how British are you, or are you actually Germanic or something? I don't know. I've never done it myself. But other things qualify too, like feminine hygiene products. That's something that they added last year. Or our favorite, you can always stock up on sunscreen for your next beach trip. That's one of those things that if you can catch it on sale, you can always spend so much less on that than you do, you know, at the grocery store, actually at the beach.
Yeah. And if you're going to lose that money anyway, go ahead and stock up on sunscreen. I usually buy it by the gallon just because
that's because you're white and pasty.
Exactly. That's how much our family needs. But Ronica, I hope that helps. Go ahead and max that out to the tune of 5K. And yeah, let's get to the next question though about HSAs, Matt, and how you can use them most effectively.
Hey, this is Caleb from Cardozola, Georgia. I've been listening to How to Money for about a week or two now. I'm currently maxing out my HSA through work. I was wondering, should I use those funds for my current medical expenses so I can build an emergency fund faster? Or should I just only use the HSA for investments at the time being and gradually build up my emergency savings? All right, thanks.
All right, Caleb, thank you for being a new How to Money listener, and hopefully you were listening to our answer to Ronica, because we touched on this a little bit when it came to talking about FSAs, because no way should you use those HSA funds if it is at all possible to avoid it. We've talked in depth about HSAs before, and you can listen back to episode 105 where we really went point by point through HSAs and how it is we feel that you should use them. But basically,
and why everyone who has access should take full advantage.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we feel that HSAs are even better than Roth IRAs for many folks, and that's because of the triple tax advantage that these accounts are eligible for. There are no other retirement accounts out there that have it this good. You don't get taxed on the money that you contribute, you don't get taxed on the growth of that money, nor do you get taxed on the withdrawals when you take them out. And so, yeah, there truly is nothing better than having a zero tax vehicle in which to grow your wealth.
That's right. It's really one of a kind. I mean, there's almost nothing else out there where you can invest your money and make money tax-free. HSAs are kind of like a unicorn. They've got like kind of unicorn status.
But a unicorn with like three prongs. Right. Or three horns instead of one.
I was going to say, like, the other thing that comes to mind is live in flips. That's another way to generate wealth without having to pay taxes. But the HSA, a lot more people are going to take advantage of that than they are, you know, doing their own reno work at their house and hopefully selling it down the road to make money. But both of those are helpful from a tax standpoint. And yeah, the problem is that a lot of folks either forego contributing to their HSA altogether, that's not good, or even if they can and are contributing money to their HSA, they do it in the wrong way. Well, how can you do it wrong, you might ask? Well, by sticking that money in and taking it right back out to fund immediate healthcare expenses that pop up. Sure, you get that single, one-time tax benefit now if you go that route, and that is a nice benefit. But the HSA is so powerful that if you instead invest the money inside of that HSA and you leave it to compound for decades and take it out way down the road, you're going to be way better off. And so it's important to note that this does involve a little bit of record keeping. You want to keep track of all your healthcare expenses in like a Google document, but it's totally worth it because it allows you to fully take advantage of what the HSA, the benefits that it can provide. And Matt, you defined the terms HSA as a health savings account, but we have said it should be for anybody who cares about growing their money and growing their wealth, it should be called an HIA, a health investment account, because that is how it's best used. And I think just that term, what it's called, actually leads people down the wrong path for how to use the HSA properly. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Because, well, on that note, I mean, it's one thing to call it an HSA if you're thinking about like a health spending account, which doesn't exist. It's a health savings account. But like you said, Joel, it needs to be a health investing account, truly, because the other way that you can use your HSA poorly is if you don't put those dollars to work by actually investing them. If you truly do treat it like a savings account and you're putting that money in there and it's sitting there as cash, if it's sitting there in those savings type options, then your HSA won't experience the growth that it otherwise could.
Yeah, and the great thing is it can almost act like a secondary emergency fund over time because you can pull that money out willy-nilly if you have a qualified medical expense. Even if that medical expense happened 5-10 years ago, you can say, you know what, I need the money now. But at least it's been growing for those 5 or 10 years until you actually do need it.
That's right.
But Caleb, hopefully that helps you out. And Matt, let's get back to the beer that we had on this episode. This one is called Schmoogie Box. And it's by Imprint Beer Company. What were your thoughts on this one?
So before we hit record, you're just like, I feel like an idiot saying the name of this beer, which is why I said it at the beginning of the episode, because
I feel like a small child. Like, and I will say, we've talked about this before.
Schmoogie Box.
I don't love the beer industry going towards like Capri Sun sort of imagery, because I feel like that's a little...
Is that what you feel like this is going towards?
It's a little lame. Yeah, okay. I don't like it.
Well, basically, this is a fruited sour beer, and it says on the side of it, Smoogie Style Ale. Which, what does that even mean? Like, they've got it listed out like we all know what that means. But this is a fruited sour ale.
It's a made-up word that they came up with.
Yeah, it's got mango, passion fruit, key lime, and cheesecake. What were your thoughts on this beer, Joel?
Okay, so the reason I picked it up was not because of the name or the branding, because I didn't really like either, but because the reviews of this beer, going back to what we talked about at the very beginning of the episode, they were great. And so I was like, this, all right, it's worth it. It's worth it because it was in the single section. I was like, let's give this one a shot. I'll say it was pretty good. But it didn't live up to those reviews that I read. And yeah, it had a very passion fruit heavy, had definitely some peach notes going on. And it did have like actually a little bit of like peach mouthfeel. There was almost like some pulp in there, it tasted like to me.
Oh, definitely had. I mean, it was super thick.
Yeah.
Basically, like you got your servings of fruit when you drink this beer.
That's
because,
good to know. I needed them today.
It's like drinking some naked juice or Odweiler or something like that.
That's true. Yeah, it totally had that kind of vibe going on. And the flavors, I would say, were good, but it was... I don't know. This isn't going to be one that I go back to anytime soon.
Do you remember what the rating was on this one in particular?
I want to say it was like 4.5 on Untappd.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I would give it 4.5, but it's really dang close. I think I like this more than you do.
Okay.
I'm going to argue maybe that you were affected, impacted by the poor branding, maybe the fact that you had to say Schmoogie or or whatever.
I'm judging the beer by its label. I'm
but
sorry.
Here's something that I noted, and it mentioned it on the side, is that it has key lime in it. And that sharpness, I think, is what maybe brought this beer around for me, because if it was just those heavy sweet flavors of those more tropical dense fruits without the, I don't know, sharp lime to cut through it, I felt like this beer would have maybe landed flat for me. But because it had that kind of crispness, that acidity, like it, to me, it almost tasted like it had like ginger, fresh ginger in it. I had like a fresh, fancy fresh pressed juice recently that had ginger in it, and this took me back to that morning when I was drinking that juice. And it also claims having some cheesecake in there, I feel like, and so I think that added to the creaminess. But it also kind of added a little bit of that kind of nuttiness that you get from like the cheesecake, like a graham cracker crust a little bit as
okay.
well.
All right.
So it kind of, it made it seem more like not just a fruited sour, but maybe one of those pastry sours as well, which normally I'm not for, but I actually could totally get on board with this one. Next time I see one of these on the shelf, I might actually grab one of these myself, maybe to share with Kate.
There you go. All right, well, you know what? Best friends can disagree from time to time.
Different strokes for different folks, man. That's what they say.
We'll duke it out after we're done recording. Just kidding. All right, well, that's going to do it for this episode. We love taking your listener questions. And if anybody else out there listening says, I've got an interesting oddball question to ask Matt and Joel on an upcoming Ask HTM episode, we'd love to hear it. We do love the oddball ones. So go to our website at howtomoney.com/ask, and you'll find the simple instructions to record and send us your voice memo, and we hope to take it really soon.
That's right. And Joel, we talked about reviews a couple times now on this episode, and if you haven't left us a review, we would appreciate your honest feedback. Just don't be the guy leaving the one-star review of like, oh, it's a podcast. They talk, not for me, because that doesn't provide any
sticking to YouTube
helpful feedback for anybody. But were you to leave us a solid review, we would appreciate you. Joel, that's going to be it for this episode, buddy. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.